The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest this week is Jonathan Clements, speaking on the burdens of taxation on small businesses and the emerging tax risk at death. Here comes another tax, which most people would think don't affect them, but wait until you see it. You know, today we're going to focus on overcoming barriers or mistakes that could alter your retirement plans and that either delay that eventual date or alter the lifestyle that you experience during your retirement. And a lot of what should be discussed seems simple. Other ideas are just common sense. And a few concepts we're going to discuss reflect changes in thinking. So whether you are just starting your working career, you're 20 years away, raising kids, worried about college costs, maybe 10 years away, or you find yourself suddenly unemployed, hopefully today's show will put you on the right path. So this seems like a more of a potpourri show, and that doesn't mean the ideas aren't important, but rather than one theme, it's multiple themes. Where do we begin?
Well, let's start out with savings. I mean, if you think of retirement, okay, how's that going to come about? Are you going to get a pension? Are you going to have savings? Or are you going to need a combination of above? And most people, when they think about retirement, think of, well, I got to put money aside. Most individuals, if you work in the private sector, you probably have a 401k program. If you work in the public sector, you have things like 403b plans or 457 plans. But what you're really trying to do when you're planning for a retirement is get to your number. For retirement, it's pretty simple. I mean, you look at your budget, you determine what you're going to need to live each year. And once you know what that number is, and of course, that number is different for everyone, depending on your own lifestyle and also where you live. But once you know that number, you subtract your known sources of income. Like, for example, if you work for the government, you might have a pension. Or if you're in the private sector, you may have Social Security, or some companies still offer pension plans. And the balance, after you subtract that from your living expenses, is what you need to be made up by your investments. Or, as we're seeing and we've discussed on this program, more and more individuals are working part-time or using work as part of their retirement solution.
Now, we've discussed a lot of this before, Jim, but the earlier you get started, the less you need to save to get that key number reached, or the more you're going to have to do when you retire.
Yeah, I mean, it all gets down to simple math. The longer the time period that you have to save, the more time that money has to grow and compound. There's no magic to it. Compound interest itself is the magic. But today, that has become more important with how most retirement plans work, which are basically 401k programs. And the great thing about some of these programs is you have employer match. So you put in a buck, your employer puts in a buck or 50 cents, depending on the capabilities of your employer. So it's not just the fact that your savings are compounding your wealth, but your employer is also contributing as well. And like anything else, the earlier you start, the more money your employer adds to your own pot of wealth to fund your retirement.
Okay, let's demonstrate this point with an example that really drives it home, because it really illustrates how easy it is to do this, as well as the magic of compounding.
When we talk examples, obviously this is radio, so, you know, this isn't visual medium, but let's just stick with some very simple numbers. And let's just assume that you plan on retiring 40 years from now. You want to have $1 million at retirement, and, you know, you're going to have income from Social Security, maybe you have pensions. So let's say you start work at age 26. And you're going to retire at age 66 and get full retirement benefits. Actually, 40 years from now, it'll be age 67, probably closer to 69. But for illustration, let's just assume it's 66. So you're going to work for 40 years before you retire. And assuming that you can earn over a long period of time anywhere from 6 to 8%, this will really demonstrate why you want to start out earlier and why it's more achievable. At age 26, you have 40 years from retirement. You would only have to put away, now listen to this number, $286 a month to reach that goal. And imagine if your employer matched you 100%, they would add $143. Or another way to look at it is, well, if I need to put away $286, if my employer matches me, it's only $143 a month. Now, fast forward another 10 years. Now we only have 30 years to retirement. That number jumps to $670 or $335 if you have matching contributions from your employer. And here's where you start to drive home the point about waiting too long to start saving. At age 46, you're 20 years away now. That number jumps to almost $1,700. It's actually $1,697. Half of that, if your employer contributes, it's $848. 10 years away from retirement at age 56, it's almost unachievable unless you're Larry Lotsabucks, because by that time, you have to put aside almost $5,500 a month. It's actually $5,466 and $2,733 if your employer has matching contributions. Now, it gets a little better, because remember, when you put that dollar in your 401k program, your 403b or 457, that's tax deductible. It's called above the line deduction. It's on the front page of your tax return. It reduces your taxable income. You take an average couple today, maybe paying 30% in taxes. At age 26, you're saving $200 a month. You only need to save $200 a month after tax, $469 at age 36, $509 age 46, and $1,639 at age 56. So a couple things. Starting early requires a small investment. It could be as little as $143. Back out taxes, it's even less than that. The longer you wait, the more you're going to have to contribute. And think of this. If you have an employer that is matching your contributions, for every dollar you save, they add a dollar to your own savings. Think of how much more your employer is going to contribute to your own retirement.
Well, it is obvious that when you add the tax savings plus the employer contributions, this becomes a no-brainer. And the point being made here, of course, is the earlier you get started, the sooner and greater your chances are of reaching your retirement goals.
The reason I like to use this illustration, John, it's important because when couples first start out getting married, there's so many important goals that couples have, from paying down student debt, saving for a home, or maybe let's say saving for their kids' education. And usually at a young age, retirement is probably the furthest thing from your mind. Look, you just got out of college, maybe you got married, you're just starting out life, and you're thinking, you know what, retirement, age 66, 67, that's a ways out of there. So you're not even thinking about that. But the thing is, if you do think about it and think of how little it takes when you start earlier, it is really doable. I mean, you talk about those numbers I talked about, $143 a month, actually less after taxes, if you have matching contributions from your employer. John, that's probably, you know, a dinner out once a month and a few lattes, and you can put that money aside.
Okay, well, the point is clear. Start early and save regularly. Let's move on to the next issue that could become a roadblock to reaching retirement goals, and that would be?
The next roadblock, I think, is failure to understand the tax impact on investments and savings. And it's really important for individuals and families that they know their marginal tax bracket, and then they take steps to minimize taxes that they pay. I mean, it's straightforward. The less you pay in taxes, the more money you have to save and invest. It's that simple.
Okay, how do you find this number, Jim? And when you know what it is, what can you do to minimize your taxes once you know what the tax bracket is?
I mean, this is pretty straightforward. You all have to file an income tax return. And if you go on the front page of your tax return, on the very back page, it's line 43, which says taxable income. And once you know what that number is, it's very easy to go to the government tax tables, whether you're married, single, or head of household, and you can find your tax bracket. Now, what this does is this tells you what each additional dollar of income, what it'll be taxed at. So if you're in a 25% tax bracket, you get a $1,000 raise, you automatically know the government's going to take 25% of that. Likewise, if you were to, let's say, put $1,000 away into a 401k program and you're in a 25% tax bracket, you're going to save 25% of that, or $250 in taxes. So it's important because this tells you the dollars of income, what they're going to be taxed, and what you're going to save for each dollar you put away into your company or your own pension plan. And it also should guide you as to what investment strategies you pursue in saving for retirement. And you take the two, the combination of investment strategies and tax savings. John, this can have a major, major effect on your retirement plans and reaching those retirement goals, because now you're, in one sense, you're having the government help you. You're either getting a tax deduction, or you're using investments that are tax favored. In the combination, let's face it, the more money you save in taxes, the more money you have to invest.
Okay, before we go on to the next barrier that we're covering here, why don't we cover some relevant tax data, and let's briefly look at simple strategies and what they would be, because when you wade into this area, sometimes it seems confusing.
Let's just take a married couple. Most individuals, and I'm not going to start out at the lower tax brackets, but the 25% tax bracket for a married couple starts at about $75,000. It's actually $74,900, goes all the way up to $151,000. The 28% tax bracket starts at $151,000, goes to $230,000. At $230,000, you're in a 33. At $411,000, you're at a 35. And around 465, you're at the 39.6. Now, single individuals, the 25% tax bracket, this really hurts, starts at around 37,000, goes all the way to 90. A little over 90,000, you're in a 28% bracket, 189, 33, 411, 35, and 413, the 39.6. I wish it was that easy, but it isn't. Because if you're married and you've earned 250, you have to pay an additional 0.9% Medicare tax. And if you're single, it's 200,000. And it gets worse than that, because they also start to phase out your deductions. The standard deduction, that means if you're not itemizing your deductions, roughly about 12,600 for a married couple. It's about 6,300 if you're single. But then they start phasing out these exemptions. If you're married, between 309,000 and 432. If you're single, between 258 and 380. And then, of course, there's the alternative minimum tax, and then there's also capital gains. And capital gains rates can be as little as zero if you're below the 25% income tax bracket. Think about that. If you're below the 25% income tax bracket, long-term capital gains rate is zero. If you are above the 25% tax bracket, it's 15% to 20%, depending on the income that you earn. And also, there's other capital gains rates. There's the capital gains rate on collectibles, which includes bullion, is 28%. On small business stock, it's 28%. On recapture of a 1250 gain, that's 25%. So you can see, John, the complexity of the tax code. And it is something that is catching a lot of people. There's even taxation of Social Security benefits, which can range from 50% of your benefits being taxable to 85% of your benefits taxable. Everywhere you look, they're looking for ways to get more tax revenues. And this is why it's really important that you understand this in your planning, so you can minimize this with appropriate strategies.
Okay, what about strategies? I mean, given this information, what can be done to minimize the tax bite, because the push on taxes is getting ever larger?
Well, I mean, as we start out talking about saving, the simplest thing is to contribute to your company pension plan. For most of you listening, if you're in the private sector, it's probably a 401k program. It's called an above-the-line tax deduction. That's on the front page of your tax return. And that helps you, because it not only reduces your taxable income, but also could help in saving you in terms of phasing out part of your itemized deductions and exemptions. The next strategy is to take advantage of what we call below-the-line deductions. These are things like itemized deductions that most people are familiar with. Mortgage interest on your home, property taxes you pay, state income taxes you pay, charitable contributions. And these are the things that are going to reduce your taxable income depending on what levels you make. At a certain level, they start phasing out part of those deductions. So after that, it is understanding. The next thing is you want to understand how investments are taxed. So you want to use, if you're saving for retirement, it just makes a whole lot of sense to use investments where they have some kind of tax favorability. For example, dividends are taxed at either 0 to 15% to 20%. real estate. If you own rental properties, can be sheltered. The rents can be sheltered by depreciation. You can invest in things like master limited partnerships, which are partnerships listed on the stock exchange where part of the dividends are tax sheltered. We're all familiar with tax-free bonds. And then there's tax deferrals, such as tax deferred annuities or your pension plans. The point is, all your investments should be tax advantaged because most people are probably closer to that 25% tax bracket at the federal level, if not more. On top of that, you add your state taxes on top of that. The whole point is to minimize taxes on your savings and investments so that you accumulate more. And when done over time, it can make a dramatic difference in your wealth accumulation. The best example I can cite is Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett has never paid more than 15 to 20% tax rates his entire working career. No wonder he's the second richest man in the world besides being a very shrewd investor. He's also a shrewd businessman in terms of the taxes he pays. So, you know, at some point, John, we ought to do a whole show on this because it can have a dramatic, powerful impact on your wealth accumulated, especially if done over a long period of time, which is why Buffett is as wealthy as he is. He's been paying minimal taxes since the time he was in high school. I mean, he really understood this and has used it in Berkshire Hathaway as really his personal tax shelter.
So next to beginning your savings early for retirement, the next mistakes that people make or barriers to overcome, you have to minimize your taxes, which of course puts more money in your pockets, and to minimize the taxes on your investments so you earn a higher return that can compound over time, which helps you build a substantial retirement nest egg, giving you a more secure retirement. So what's next on your retirement barriers that we need to hurdle or a mistake that you want to avoid?
You know, the next one is a little bit more difficult for many parents, which is funding their children's education. I mean, if Junior is an Einstein, you know, what parent wouldn't want their kid to go to Harvard? Education is probably a growing out of control expense, and it's saddling many parents and children today with mountains of debt. In fact, it's becoming a major issue in this election. And it usually happens at a critical time in your retirement dateline, usually 10 to 15 years before retirement. This really requires a major reset in thinking about education because it's almost like, John, it's going to be a paradigm shift. Because really what you want to do is minimize the cost of education and avoid taking on debt. Traditionally, a big mistake that I see made with a lot of couples is they'll allocate a major portion of their savings and resources towards education to the detriment of their own retirement. I mean, if you take a look at state education, depending on where you go, it can run $80,000 to $100,000 for a four-year program. If you're going to private school, that's $150,000 to as much as $200,000. You know, you multiply that by two or three kids, and John, you're talking about a small fortune or almost like buying a house.
We are in silly season right now, running up to the 2016 elections, and the politicians are now talking about free education. The problem is, now we theoretically have free public school education, but they're talking about free college education. But there is no such thing as free. Whenever something is given to one person, somebody else has to pay for it. If it isn't the person receiving it, somebody else has to do it. And we've done multiple programs on education, but you know, your concept of 2+2 and work and stay, meaning stay at home, makes a lot of sense. So let's cover this as to why this can dramatically alter retirement outcomes at critical times before retirement.
Well, the 2+2 program is something that we used, and I've advocated it many times on this program and also in a lot of the financial plans we do for a lot of working couples. 2+2 means 2 years spent at a junior college and 2 years at a state college because you can dramatically bring your cost down to almost $20,000 for a four-year degree. Now, that may sound ridiculous. I mean, for most people, that's probably just 1 year's tuition. But it's possible with this program to bring your cost down to $20,000. And I'll demonstrate here from my own state of California. And the next idea is even better financially is called work and stay. Instead of going off to college, dorm, and all the expenses of being away from home, Junior stays at home, gets a job, gets work experience, eventually knows what he wants to do for a living. He attends classes online or at a junior college, which is less expensive. For example, a junior college here, one of the colleges I sent my kids to, the annual tuition is $1,288. Now, that does include books. Books are almost as expensive, but it's $1,288, and that's for in-state residents. So you're talking roughly about $2,600 for a two-year degree, not counting books. So if you're staying at home and working, you don't have room and board, and you just have tuition and books. Now, you can get that down to a reasonable cost. And then if, for example, you want to go to, let's say, one of the colleges in the city, for example, here I chose San Diego State, where one of my sons went, the annual tuition is $3,488 a semester, or $6,976 for a full year tuition. And they estimate on their website about $1,800 of books and supplies. So, John, it is possible, including books and supplies, to get a four-year degree for $20,000. That's certainly a lot more affordable for parents and students. And what's even more important here, it would really help the student get a head start on life, because they'd walk out of college with no burden of student loans or debt. And that's going to give them a head start out on life. I've seen parents take out mortgages on homes. I've seen where the bulk of almost 80% of their savings, where they're not even fully realizing or taking advantage of their 401k programs because the cost of education, John. And I just think it's the cost of education. It's a government monopoly, and it's getting more expensive as a monopoly. And I think sending junior away to school, even a state school, away could run as much as $80,000 a year to $100,000, or as much as $150,000 to $200,000 for a private education. Makes a lot more sense if junior stays at home, no room and board. Two, gets a job out of high school, so you're earning money instead of borrowing money. And then you get work experience, go to junior college or online college, you know, get a two-year degree for about $2,600 plus books. Or let's say your four-year degree with 2 years at a state college, that will run you roughly about $14,000 or $15,000. So, John, it just makes a whole lot more sense, and especially for parents that have more than one kid.
Now, what if you're fortunate enough to be able to save to pay for college? What's the best investment way to save? I mean, obviously, nowadays, given the interest rates, a savings account won't do it.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, my favorite is 529 plans invested in stocks. And especially if you have, you know, like a newborn, you have a long period of time to compound. Putting money in a stock mutual fund over a long period of time is going to compound and grow a lot more. And the reason I like them in 529 plans is the gains, appreciation, the dividends are tax-free when used to pay for a college education. Because what you don't want to do is, let's take my case of, let's say, planning on $20,000 for junior staying at home, 2 years at a junior college and 2 years at a state college. Let's say the cost is $20,000. Let's say you want to pay for that yourself. So you're saving for $20,000. If you're putting a small amount a month into a mutual fund and it grows over a period of time, that $20,000 will be tax-free when you need it to pay for those college costs.
All right, let's sum up the five barriers here, or the mistakes to avoid when you're trying to prep for retirement. Number one, this is a theme which you've heard over and over again, start saving early. That gives you more time to plan. It provides more money over the course of the saving period. Number two, know where you stand in the tax bracket. And a very close corollary of that is number three, minimize taxes by exclusions and deductions and other things that you can legitimately do to reduce your tax burden. And number four, use tax-efficient investments so that when they do produce income for you, you're not returning a lot of that to the government. And number five, avoid over allocating savings or overpaying for college. Okay, now it's time to move on to the next part of the program, which, as always, traditionally, is a case study of a real world example. This is a real life example taken from, hey, you guessed it, real life, except we changed the names to protect the privacy of the individual. So who is the lucky couple this week?
This week, we're going to talk about Mark and Jennifer Thompson, a young couple starting out. Mark was age 30. He was a marketing sales for a biotech firm. Jennifer, age 26, a dental hygienist. They had one child, a daughter named Natalie. One year, they do plan on having more children. They were referred to us by Jennifer's parents, who are a client of ours, and they wanted to start out with a plan. In like any couple, if you think about it, if you're listening to this, your own children, or maybe you're just newly married or freshly starting out at college, they had many goals. One of the first goals that they wanted, they live in an apartment, they wanted to have enough money to eventually buy a home. The second thing, having Natalie, now 1 year of age, they were thinking of their own education. They wanted to start planning for their own daughter's education and any future children that may arrive down the road. Third is they wanted to pay off the last amount of student debt, which was roughly about $30,000. A lot of that on Mark's side, and most of that was being paid down. And then on the back end, as most couples starting out, was retirement, which was, you know, quite honestly, at this point, 40 years away for most of them. Now, their combined income was roughly about $120,000 per year. They're living in an apartment with food, car payments, that was running about $5,000 per month. Taxes were running about $3,000, which left close to $2,000 for savings. Now, what we did is we sat down with them and they said, okay, we can't do all these things. I mean, it would be nice, but you're fortunate enough that you're living within your means, you're living comfortably, and you have the ability to save, and you're still young. And so the first thing that we wanted to do was pay down the student debt. We wanted to get that out of the way. And the second priority was to save for a home. And I also wanted them to contribute to their retirement plans because it did two things. Number one, getting back to the example, the earlier you start and allow your money to compound, the more money you're going to have down the future. And secondly, it was giving them a tax deduction. So in many ways, the government was financing part of this because they were in a 35% tax bracket. They were in a 25% federal, 9.3% for the state of California, so almost a 35% bracket. Now, Mark could get bonuses on the end of the year, depending on how well he did and the company did, that could be as much as 1 month salary, sometimes even more. The goal was to use those bonuses and allocate that money to pay down his student loan, and then the rest would be used to put money aside for savings for the home, because that was one of the big priorities, because it'd do a number of things. Number one, it'd get him out of rent. Number two, mortgage deductions, property tax deductions, and boy, our rent's expensive here in California, at least are tax deductible on the tax return. So that would reduce their taxable income and have the government subsidize part of that. The other thing I wanted them to do was maximize their 401k contributions. Jennifer's employer matched 50%. In Mark's case, it was 100% up to a certain level of their income. So we wanted to increase their 401k contributions to $700 a month. That would roughly cost them about $500 a month, basically after taxes. So the goal was use the bonus to pay down the student loans, use the monthly savings. First priority would be to put those savings, or a good majority of it, into a 401k program because there were matching contributions. You know, you take that over 40 years and you're talking about a large amount of money over that time frame that's going to be able to compound. The next thing that we wanted to do when it came to education, I said, look, once you've got the money for the student loans, the student loan is paid off, you've got the money for the down payment on a house, then let's start talking about education expenses. And I explained to him the 2+2 concept, you know, or the work and stake concept, which made a lot of sense to him. And especially since, you know, part of the problem that we had right here was $30,000 of student loan debt that still had to be paid. You know, when I showed him, we have a program that tracks tuition and board and room at various colleges. And so when I showed him that and we talked about this, you know, you can get your education cost down to $25,000 for each child, you know, Natalie and those that may come in the future. you know, that sort of kind of took a little bit of a burden off him because, you know, you're thinking of, you know, in Mark's case, his education was closer to the $80,000 figure that we talked about. And same with Jennifer, except for Jennifer's parents did something a little bit different and had the help of their grandparents. So it was much easier. And she was able to get out of college with no student debt. So it was mainly on Mark's side. And so that made a lot of sense to them when we were talking about college planning. And what it is, it's like any couple starting out in life, you have so many goals. You know, maybe you want to pay off the student loans. You want to get that dream home that you want to live in someday. You want to pay for your kids' education or help them with their education expenses. And, you know, down the road, you're thinking about retirement, which is further away. And this way, it was simply prioritizing and changing the paradigm of looking at college differently, which sort of took some of that burden off. Oh, if it's only going to cost $20,000 and, you know, we're talking about 20 years away, well, that was probably doable. And so, John, that's what we did with this couple. The great thing is they're young enough. They're starting out on the right foot. They're saving. They're paying down their debt. They're putting money away in a 401k program with matching contributions. And, John, they're on the right path to a good retirement.
Coming up next, Jonathan Clements is our guest this week. The burdens of taxation on businesses and tax risk at the time of death. Congress is proposing, or at least the politicians are proposing, more of them. All of that coming up next as Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his Lifetime Income Specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, for many Americans, it's a dream to run and start your own business. For others, it's been a necessity. As a result of the financial crisis, many Americans lost their jobs and found themselves working for themselves. But there could be some problems, and one of them is taxes. Joining us on the program from the Wall Street Journal is Jonathan Clements. John, why don't we talk about some of the things that are different when you work for yourself versus working for another employer? And you gave an example, an article you recently wrote for the journal, which is basically an example of an individual that makes $100,000, the difference in taxes for that individual working for an employer, working for himself. And then also, let's say if you're making $100,000 and you were retired.
Yeah, the numbers, Jim, are quite shocking. Working for yourself, you know, is in fact a dream of many Americans. And indeed, I'm self-employed. You know, I freelance for different publications. I write books, but I am self-employed. And one of the things that you discover once you're self-employed is that you have to pay this big additional tax. And the big additional tax is the full Social Security and Medicare payroll tax. So normally, if you're working for a company, you pay half of that payroll tax and your employer pays the other half. So your cut is 7.65%. But if you're self-employed, you have to pay both halves of that Social Security payroll tax. And so as a consequence, on that hypothetical example, somebody earning $100,000 a year, what that means is you're paying $5,000 extra in taxes per year compared to somebody who works for an employer. And as a consequence, what you find is that between federal income taxes, federal payroll taxes, and potentially state income taxes, it's quite possible that you'll be losing a third of your income to taxes each year.
And you know something, what's remarkable about that, Jonathan, in today's age, $100,000, I suppose if you lived somewhere in the Midwest, that might be a lot of money. But $100,000, if you're living in California or on the East Coast, like New York, New Jersey, $100,000 certainly doesn't buy you a mansion.
Yes, certainly in this part of the country, I live in New York City, $100,000 would barely put you in the middle class. It's astonishing how expensive it is to live in this city. But maybe even more astonishing is the mismatch between how much we celebrate entrepreneurship, we encourage people to go out on their own and innovate. And historically, that has been how the economy has grown. Small business has been the biggest source of job growth in this country historically. And yet, it is indeed extraordinarily expensive. And of course, taxes are just the beginning. If you set out on your own, you're also looking at paying for your own health and disability insurance. You know, you're not going to get any time off. Anytime you're not working, you're not getting paid. Also, you have to fund your entire retirement without any help from an employer putting money into a 401k plan for you. So as a consequence, a lot of people who dream of being self-employed discover that it's really way too expensive, and they end up giving up on the dream and heading back to find a full-time job with somebody else.
You know, it's interesting because we had our IT person who was basically running his own business. That's exactly what he did. When he added up all his costs for, you know, medical insurance, disability insurance, life insurance, which he would have to pay for himself. Then he added his self-employment tax and all the expenses and the accounting that you have to do for producing your own business. He actually took a IT job with a larger company.
Yeah, and I think that's unfortunate because, as I said, you know, historically, you know, most of the economic growth and the job growth that we've seen have come from small businesses, and small businesses start with people, you know, heading off on their own, being self-employed, and then if they really do well, they start to take on other employees, and those little businesses become big ones. And yet, you know, as I said, the tax code and many other facets of finances are stacked against somebody who is working for themselves. So it's an unfortunate situation. I don't have an easy answer for it. One of the things that people say in response when I bring up the high cost of being self-employed, they say, oh yeah, but you can deduct this and you can deduct that. But this notion of something being tax deductible, you know, is overstated somewhat. I mean, if you're in the 25% income tax bracket and you incur a dollar of expenses, you can only save 25 cents in taxes. The other 75 cents is coming out of your pocket. Nobody ever got rich by claiming tax deductions.
No, because basically a tax deduction, as you just pointed out, Jonathan, is an expense. So if I have to pay for my own, let's say, health insurance, that's an expense to me. Yeah, I can deduct it being self-employed. But once again, that's dollars out of my pocket.
Yeah, I mean, you can't, you know, as I said in my example, you know, every dollar out of your pocket might save you 25 cents in taxes, but the other 75 cents, that's going to be your cost. The only area where it seems like being self-employed is potentially a big bonus is you can put away a lot more for retirement than if you work for an employer. For instance, if you're age 50 or over and you set up a solo 401k plan, in 2015, you could potentially put away $59,000 between your contribution and your contribution as the employer. But the problem is, in order to sock away that sort of money, you clearly have to be making substantially more than that because you have to cover your living expenses as well. So while those high thresholds for retirement account contributions are attractive, only a relatively limited number of the self-employed are going to be able to take advantage of it.
Yeah, because once you start reaching a certain limit, especially as a result of the Tax Act of 2012, you can lose part of your itemized deductions. You can lose part of your exemptions. You could pay a surtax on your income. You could pay an additional Medicare tax on income over the Social Security threshold. So there are a lot of things that start kicking in as you move into those brackets.
Well, you're sort of getting onto a related topic here, Jim, which is, of course, one of the things that we've seen over the past three decades is this increasing complexity of the U.S. tax code. You go back to 1986, and we had the Tax Reform Act, and the tax code was substantially cleaned up. But in the years since, we've seen new deductions added, new credits added, special savings accounts set up. As a consequence, you know, you fast forward to 2015, and the U.S. tax code is just unbelievably complicated. Today, the vast majority of people pay tax preparer to prepare their tax return because it's simply too complicated, and most of the rest, I would wager, are using software on their own in order to do it. The days when you could sit down with a calculator and a pencil and figure out your taxes yourself are long gone.
You know, it's amazing because I can remember when I first got in this business, Jonathan, we had higher tax rates. They used to be as high as 70%, but we had all kinds of things we could deduct. You could deduct your sales tax. If you invested in real estate, there was no limitation in terms of your write-offs. You had tax shelters, all kinds of tools that we used. Now, the Tax Reform Act of 86 brought the tax rates down to 28%, but in exchange for that, they got rid of some of the deductions, they got rid of the tax shelters, the write-offs, with the idea that, look, if we lower the tax low enough, you won't have to do this stuff and you can do more productive things. But since then, we have just added layer upon layer, and it's getting worse, of all kinds of complications that make the tax code quite complex, and especially for somebody that is starting their own business.
Yeah, because, you know, it's not just the income tax, the federal income tax, and of course the state income tax you have to deal with. You have to deal with those payroll taxes. You've got the alternative minimum tax, which is a big issue for anybody living on either of the two coasts, and they have high itemized deductions, principally because of income taxes. And then, of course, we have the new 3.8% Medicare surtax that hits people earning more than $200,000 if they're single or head of household, or $250,000 and up if they're married filing jointly. And those tax thresholds aren't indexed for inflation. So more and more people are going to get hit by them in the years ahead. The consequence is, you know, their tax return is just inordinately complicated. And then, of course, on top of that, you mentioned the various days out, personal exemptions and itemized deductions that happen at even higher income levels. That's a further level of complexity that, you know, if we ever got a major rewriting of the tax code, and I think it's coming, I think we're going to see it in the next couple of years. Hopefully, a lot of this nonsense will get cleared out and we'll have a much simpler tax code as a consequence. At least that is my fondest hope.
You know, I've thought about that, and you're seeing this being raised in the presidential election about simplifying the tax code. There seems to be at least some agreement doing it on the corporate side with the highest corporate tax rates in the world. But the other thing is, my greatest fear is, I remember the tax reform in 86, where we did get the lower tax rates. They were lowered from 50 to 28%. Got rid of the tax deductions, but, you know, the next president started raising taxes, and the one after him.
It's true. I mean, you know, the problem with simplifying the tax code is, you know, it normally doesn't stay that way. I remember back in 1986, an accountant boasting, you know, my kids will go to college on the money I make off tax simplification. Tax simplification rarely stays that way for long. Before we got on air, Jim, you were mentioning some of the proposals that are out there right now. One of the things that is going on and could come out in a tax reform bill is some change in the rules that affect inherited individual retirement accounts. And this is a big issue for most Americans. Most Americans will not have to worry about paying federal estate taxes, but they will have to worry about the embedded income tax bill on the IRAs that they inherit. Roughly 0.2% of people who die each year leave behind estates that are taxable at the federal level, but 50% of people who die each year leave behind IRAs or similar retirement accounts. And those retirement accounts, the income taxes owed on those withdrawals from those retirement accounts still have to be paid after your death. One of the proposals that's kicking around right now is that instead of allowing people to draw down those accounts slowly over time, they may be forced to empty them within 5 years. And as a consequence, a lot of people who inherit IRAs from their parents may suddenly be forced to empty these accounts very quickly. Those are substantial accounts. They could find themselves suddenly adding $100,000 or $200,000 for their income in a single year, and that might push them into the top income tax bracket.
Not only will it push them in a higher tax bracket, and maybe, Jonathan, we ought to take some time and explain right now the way the rules are. Let's just make this simple. Let's say I had a $300,000 IRA, and I pass on, I have three children, and I name all three of my children equal share in that IRA, so each child would get $100,000. The way the laws work now, maybe you can take over here and explain how they can then, as the laws are now, that child could take that $100,000 and take it out over their life expectancy over the five-year proposal that they're talking about right now.
Yes, exactly. So say you have those three kids, they each receive $100,000 IRA. Under current rules, they can use a strategy known as the stretch IRA. And what that means is they can draw down that IRA slowly over their lifetime. Why is that valuable? Well, not only do they have smaller amounts coming out of the IRA each year, which is added to their taxable income, but the remaining money in the account can continue to grow tax deferred. And that continued tax deferral can be enormously valuable. Now, the proposal is that most people who inherit IRAs. Spouses would be exempt from this, but most people who inherit IRAs would have to empty the account within 5 years. So those kids who are getting $100,000 each, they would have to pull out that $100,000 within 5 years. They're not going to get much continued tax-deferred growth out of the account, and the money they pull out is going to be added to their taxable income. If they've already got a substantial income, the $100,000 is going to get added on top of that, so it's all going to get taxed at their marginal tax rate. That means that if they're in the 33% marginal tax rate, they could probably lose a third of that account to taxes, and so the $100,000 inheritance might turn out to be just $67,000.
As we talk about this, is this something that is getting widespread support? In other words, are both parties looking at this, or is it just one party? Because, you know, with the Republicans in control of Congress right now, at least until the next election, most tax increase proposals, including the ones proposed by the president in the State of the Union, have gone nowhere. Does this have widespread support?
You know, Jim, I think what we're seeing is a realization that there will need to be either less spending or more revenue down the road. And to the extent that there can be provisions passed that don't look like tax increases, Republicans are likely to sign on. And the fact is, you know, the issue is sufficiently complicated that it's not one of those ones that's going to cause big blaring headlines. To the average American, the loss of the stretch IRA is a significant loss. I mean, this is one of the major assets that people bequeath, and using the stretch IRA is a way for their beneficiaries to get a lot of value out of these inherited retirement accounts. If it goes away, it does have severe financial consequences for the beneficiaries, but it's sufficiently complicated that I think Republicans will get behind it. Indeed, if you go back to 2013, there was bipartisan support for getting rid of the stretch IRA, and it became very close to getting passed.
You know, that's the unfortunate thing, because the code has become so complex. A lot of Americans aren't aware of what the stretch IRA does, because I've seen where, you know, a big mistake often made is they'll name the trust as the beneficiary, or the, let's say, secondary beneficiary rather than a spouse, and causing this tax consequence. And you're right. It's so complex. I mean, pension rules themselves are complex when you analyze them. But, you know, most Americans aren't thinking about this. If the politicians, like you said, Jonathan, came out and said, we're going to raise tax rates another 3 or 4%, everybody knows what that means. They're going to take more as a percentage. But something like this on the back end that comes as an inheritance, when a loved one or your parents pass on, is something that most people aren't aware of, don't give it much thought. And so you're probably right. When you can sneak a tax increase and nobody knows about it, they'll probably do it.
By contrast, and again, we were talking about this before the show, one of President Obama's proposals earlier this year was to get rid of something called the step-up in basis upon debt. What we mean here is, let's say you own a stock in a regular taxable account, and that stock is worth substantially more than the price you paid. When you die, that embedded capital gains tax bill disappears. So the cost basis for tax purposes is increased the cost to the price as of the date of your death, and the capital gains tax bill disappears. Now, unlike the stretch IRA, which, you know, is complicated and you don't have a lot of people lobbying in favor of it, you know, the step up in basis would have a big effect on wealthy Americans, and you can be pretty sure that that is not going to disappear without quite a fight. And it's why the proposal from President Obama didn't go anywhere this year. It was shot down almost immediately by the Republicans.
Yeah, because one of the things that was put in place, and just to throw a little color and history on this, is before Ronald Reagan came along, the estate tax rates were higher, the exemption was much, much lower, and there was tax on the death of the first spouse. You couldn't pass your assets on to your surviving spouse, and then the taxes on the final death. And what would happen is individuals or heirs, including the surviving spouse, would have to sell assets to pay the estate taxes. But many times when those assets were sold, it involved capital gains on appreciation, and then you'd get hit with a capital gains tax as well. So it was a double tax. So the step up was put in place by Reagan to eliminate that double taxation. Now that looks like they're trying to bring it back.
And as I said, I suspect that one will not fly, because there are a lot of wealthy business owners who you know, need to step up their basis in order to pass along the value of those businesses without paying a big capital gains tax bill. You have a lot of wealthy families that own stock that have appreciated greatly in value that they're hanging on to in order to get the step up in basis upon death. So I don't think that one's going down without a big fight. But stretch IRA, I can see getting killed off in a quiet evening in Congress when nobody's looking. That one, I think, unfortunately, is going to be history within a couple of years.
Let's talk about, since that does, and I know, Jonathan, you and I are on the same page. I know the way politicians think. If you can sneak a tax, not call it a tax, you know, they'll go for it. Let's talk about some alternatives. Let's just say in a couple of years from now, they pass that. Let's talk about how we can get around that or minimize it.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that people should think about doing. I mean, given the risk that the stretch IRA will go away, one thing is you might want to change your strategy in terms of paying for retirement. Historically, retirees have been told that the first accounts they should draw on in retirement are their taxable accounts. The next accounts they should draw on are their traditional IRA or traditional 401k. And then the last account they should touch is their Roth IRA or Roth 401k. And the reason behind that strategy is this. First, you want to get rid of the taxable account because that's the one that's generating tax bills each year. Next, you go for the traditional IRA. The reason being, you wait on holding that down is because you want to continue to get more tax-deferred growth out of that. And finally, you wait to last for the Roth IRA so you maximize the tax-free growth that that account offers. But now, if you think about your heirs, probably you want to start tapping your traditional IRA earlier because you want to run down the traditional IRA and then leave taxable account investments to your heirs, because the traditional IRA is going to give your heirs a big tax bill, but if you leave them taxable account investments, they'll get the step up in cost basis, and thus there won't be a big tax bill when you die for your heirs. And similarly, if you leave them a Roth IRA, that account is giving them tax-free growth, so that too would not come with a big embedded tax bill. So number one strategy for retirees is maybe start drawing more heavily on the traditional IRA and the traditional 401k, and hold off drawing down the taxable account and the Roth IRA.
What about the charitable remainder trust?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that some wealthy families might consider doing, and Jim, you'll have to excuse me because I'm definitely getting at the limits of my knowledge here, but one of the strategies that I've heard advocated is that wealthy families may want to name a charitable remainder trust as the beneficiary of their traditional IRA. And what that can allow them to do is to, again, stretch out the withdrawals. It's not as beneficial as having a traditional stretch IRA, but it is a way to stretch out the withdrawals on that IRA after the owner's death. But this is going to be a strategy that's not going to be used by your average Joe investor. This is going to be a strategy used by wealthier families.
But once again, it's another tax tool that's still out there and remains. And, you know, I just don't see them moving against that because there are a lot of wealthy families that do a lot of great work, you know, like the Gates Foundation, the Buffett Foundation. There are a lot of wealthy people that give a lot of money to charitable causes, and I don't think there'd be a reason to move against that. Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, tell them how they can read your articles. They're very insightful.
On what I'm up to, your best bet is to check in regularly at my website, jonathanclements.com. I'm blogging on there a couple of times a week, and I also post links to my latest articles wherever they appear. And if you want to get a broader look at my thinking on financial matters, you might pick up a copy of my latest book, which is the Jonathan Clements Money Guide 2015.
Jonathan, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jim.
You know, the one thing that really sobers you, Jim, here is when you talk about small business, small businesses carry much heavier burdens than the larger businesses do. And if you ask small business people, what's the one thing you're trying to deal with that's a killer, they'll almost always say taxes. You know, they look at that, taxes or regulations, depending on what kind of business it is. But either way, no matter how you dial things in or out, there's always a search for more and more and more and more taxes, and they're buried all over the place now. We're being taxed to death in some cases, literally, I think. You know, and there's rumblings of trying to reform that in Washington, but whether it happens or not, what remains to be seen.
Well, this is an election season, John, and already the politicians are promising everything to free kindergarten care to free college. So, you know, Nothing's ever free when the government proposes something. Somebody somewhere will pay the tax. Well, in the meantime, I hope you enjoyed this week's show, because it really is important that you look at these various barriers that we talked about earlier in the program, because they can make a difference as you head towards retirement or planning for retirement if you're doing it at an earlier age. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.